I got to know the late author Tony Hillerman in a very curious and roundabout way early in the 90s. And I was a science writer then, and we talked about the difference between the task that faces a science writer and the task that faces a writer of fiction. I got to know Tony fairly well, and we talked about that enough that he felt at one point comfortable challenging me something along these lines: well, you've written science, but you haven't really done anything that hard until you've tried fiction. I took it as somewhat of a challenge, and I started writing fiction early in the 90s. And the first Ohio Amish mystery was published in 1999. It was called Blood of the Prodigal. At one point, Tony remarked to me over the phone that his favorite author was James Thurber. And I tried in that conversation to convince him to come to Worcester, Ohio to talk to my seminar class about the books he wrote, because I was using Navajo murder mysteries in my seminar to teach my students about Navajo culture. So you can see there's a natural line between his type of cultural mystery and mine. I knew enough about Amish society from teaching this seminar class that I thought, well, if I'm to write fiction, why not write about Amish people in Holmes County? And all of my stories take place in Holmes County, Ohio, and they are about Amish people. Now, over the years, I have done nothing more impressive than just sort of nose around Holmes County. I've done it for the most part in a Miata with the top down on pleasant summer days and fall afternoons, and I've gotten to know quite a few people. I've collected stories, I've remembered things told to me, I've thought a lot about the cultural and religious and social issues that helped to organize Amish thought and practice and lifestyle. And my mysteries, murder mysteries, are really all about the reasons why Amish people live the way they do, separate from us, on purpose. Now, on one of my trips to Millersburg, in our Miata with a top down, I parked at the courthouse square, shut the engine down, and thought, for some strange reason, I will just sit here today and wait to see what happens. And in my Miata, I observed a fellow, older middle age, limping along a little bit with an irregular gait, coming toward me on the sidewalk some 3 blocks distant. And I observed this fellow move up to the Miata, and he stopped beside me, peered in at me as if I were a scoundrel of the worst type, and started making jokes. They were very predictable jokes and really not all that funny when you think about it, but he started in, he said, well now, how many oats does that baby take anyway? And how many horses do you have under the hood of that little number now? That kind of thing. Well, I answered a few questions. I knew he was joking around. He grew serious and considered me for a while longer, and then straight away, he looked directly into my eyes and said, how about if you drive me to Nashville? I go to Holmes County to meet people. So what do you suppose I said? Luckily, he meant Nashville, Ohio. But if he had meant Nashville, Tennessee, I promise you here today, with my wife in the front row, that I would have called home and excused myself for a good long time, and I would have taken him. This was a one-armed fellow dressed Amish, old order Amish, proper from head to toe. It's just that his arm was severed on the left side, a little bit above the elbow, and the blue long sleeve shirt that he wore was pinned up on the stump of his arm. He got in the car, looked it over from the inside, kind of got a smile on his face, and we took off on Route 39 heading out to Nashville, Ohio. We got up to about 45 miles an hour and encroached on 50, and he looked over at me with the biggest smile you can imagine and said, "Just so you'll know, I always wanted to be able to say I had gone 100 miles an hour." You can ask me later about that. In Nashville, he directed me to a house, and in the back, a metal shop. Inside, there was a man turning metal rods on his lathe. And Andy Weaver went inside, spoke with the man, talked about some things, wrote down some agreements, shook hands, came out, and got right in the Miata. Said to me, "This fellow thinks he's hot stuff, so I want you to spray a little gravel when you take out of him." Writers find good material just sitting around sometimes. Well, we went to a carpenter's shop next. The same thing happened. An agreement was made, hands were shaken. He came out with some notes, got in the car, told me next where to go. I spent the whole day with Andy Weaver, driving around. We were in three separate counties before the day was done. We went to a leather shop, a wheel shop, a place where they sharpen saw blades. And it was 11:30 at night when I finally dropped him off at the bus depot in Worcester, and he got out, asked me to step inside for a moment, and he explained to me what we had been doing. Andy Weaver travels the country in summertime on Greyhound buses and in Miatas when he can manage it. And he buys broken down sawmills and has them crated and stacked on the flat bed of a tractor trailer rig, and he instructs the driver to come north to Minnesota through Holmes County and stop first at the metal shop to have a few things fixed, and then the carpenter's shop, and then the leather shop, and the sharpen the blade and fix the drive wheels. And at the end of the summer, when Andy Weaver gets home to Minnesota, he has 9 or 10 completely refurbished sawmills packed in crates on his front lawn, which he then sells to Amish families all over America. And he's a very wealthy, old order Amish Minnesotan. Well, if you're an author and if you write about Amish people, you recognize right away that's exactly the kind of story one looks for. And I've held on to that little memory for the longest time. And I finally used a piece of it in the 6th Ohio Amish Mystery, Separate from the World. You won't recognize Andy Weaver. Sometimes microphones do not behave. You won't recognize Andy Weaver, but I think you'll recognize the attitude. Now, I'll read this passage in just a moment. I remembered to tell you one more thing. 3 months later, my wife Madonna and I came home to find a message on the answering machine. This was back when one had an answering machine in the house. The message went like this: "Paul, Paul, this is Andy. How about if you drive me to West Virginia?" Now, in the Ohio Amish Mysteries, the professor's wife bought a Miata and drove it home from New Mexico one year, just on a whim. And the Miata appears in the stories as her car, and they drive it from time to time out across Holmes County on an errand here or there. And on this trip, Professor Michael Brandon and his wife Caroline had driven up to the home of a fellow whose young son had been earlier abducted. And although this one little passage doesn't have anything to do with the abduction of the child, it does have to do with Andy Weaver. It's about a young boy who has a look at the Miata and then thinks about it this way. Daniel Erb had been watching from the corner of the big house since the Brandon's Miata had driven up and parked in front of the family store. He had seen the two Englishers go in and had taken the opportunity to move to the back corner of the store where he could see the sports car better. And as the Brandons talked with Demem inside the store, he studied the beautiful machine from his close perspective, his imagination roaming to the curvy, hilly stretches of blacktop where he had let that machine have all the speed it could handle, where he'd go 100 miles an hour and catch a glimpse of the world in a flash-by blur, taking corners like a wild man, daring fate on the crest of every hill. That was his dream, to master the English gadgets one at a time, to take hold of the ultimate gadget and make it roar, to tame a fine sports car and make it do his bidding. The other gadgets were trifles by comparison, he thought. The library had computers, but he had tired of those eventually. Cell phones had been fun, but only for a spell. Movies were just entertainment, no more exciting than the fantasies of his own mind. But the sports car, that was the ultimate challenge. There's a clue there about the mystery in the greater part of the story, but it's the notion I used from Andy Weaver that is typical of many Amish people, that they have an interest in cars that'll often surprise you. And if you drive to Holmes County and want to meet people, it's a good idea to take a sports car. Now, I've traveled Holmes County in other ways. When I was younger, I used to ride a bicycle on the gravel lanes and the little weedy two-tire tracks out across the pasture. You look at me now and might not believe there was ever a time I could ride a bicycle, but I assure you there was a time. And on a hot day, I had my bicycle on a steep slope. I was off it, pushing uphill, hot, sweaty, tired, and just about ready to give up as I passed a red barn off to the left and heard a high, reedy voice say to me, "Would you like a drink of cold spring water?" I couldn't see anyone. There was no one at the window. I wasn't sure I had heard the voice anyway, so I kept pushing on. Again, I heard the voice, "Would you like a drink of cold spring water?" And this time, I took it seriously and walked up to the window. The window of the barn was set at a normal height, and I peered inside where there was a leather shop and a harness factory, and still didn't see anyone until he spoke again, and then I saw Moni Shetler. He was standing below the windowsill. He was a dwarf Amish man of about 60 years old. I got to know him very well, drinking water out of his thermos, and I took students of mine out to visit him many times over the years. When he would have them into his tack shop, show them all around about the leather things he could make, and then ask them each to sign his register so that he could remember who his visitors were. Well, I discovered eventually that register Moni Shetler kept was filled with many more names than just those of my students. there were scientists who had been visiting Mr. Shetler from Ohio State University, Ohio University, Kent State University, and other academic concerns, and they had been coming to visit him because of his dwarfism. In fact, some of the bishops in that part of Holmes County had agreed to cooperate with genetic studies among Amish peoples because there's such a close trouble with inbreeding in a sect that is set apart from the rest of us, quite frankly. Well, Mr. Shetler was not just a dwarf. He was missing three of the fingers on his right hand. He had lost them in a threshing machine when he was a young boy. And Mr. Shetler suffered with a goiter. It looks like a traffic helicopter. Probably heard my story about 100 miles an hour. Mr. Shetler had a very large goiter, so large, in fact, that it cast his head over to the side and bent his neck pretty much like this, so that he had all of his conversations with the world from this posture. Now, he was the happiest, most well-adjusted, delightful man I have met in the longest time. And he took no difficulties to mind over the fact that he was deformed in a couple of different ways and had a hard life, really, when you get right down to it. But we talked a lot about his life and how it was different from mine. And we talked a lot about medicine and how it might be that medicine could help him. But Mr. Shetler was not one of those Amish who was very much impressed with English gadgets of any kind, and in a tragic sort of way, also not very impressed with English or Yankee medicine. And he did not participate with the bishops who were interested in genetic disorders, and he pretty much didn't go to the doctor, really, to speak of at all. He just lived a life as he thought God expected him to do, accepting his deformity for what it was, not complaining ever, that I can remember, about any of it. Well, he is the kernel around which my sixth Ohio Amish mystery was written. Separate from the world is a story about a church, an Amish sect, a congregation, that is splitting down the middle, two halves going separate ways, over the question of modern medicine, and in particular whether or not to cooperate with genetic research at fictional Millersburg College, which is designed in some ways to unravel the sources of dwarfism in particular Amish groups. And this congregation, as I describe it in Separate from the World, is very much like other congregations in Holmes County who have split over less important matters than that. There have been disagreements over cell phones. There have been disagreements over the types of pads one might put on the rim of a buggy wheel. There have been, in fact, splits in Amish congregations. Because of disagreements Amish people find themselves engaged in over all the sorts of gadgets that we English take for granted. You can name some of the more important ones readily. They are things like electricity, automobiles, phones, and the like. And some congregations are becoming modern, tending to use a few new things, and other congregations dig in harder than ever and hold on to the old ways relentlessly. So a division of an Amish church is a very real and serious affair, one that I decided to write about, mostly because of Moni Shetler, who had that drink of cold spring water for me one day back when I could still ride a bicycle. At one point in our friendship, he has since died, but at one point in our friendship, I asked him about his size. And I asked him how it was that he managed to drive a buggy, a horse-drawn buggy. I wondered really how he hitched a team, as short as he was, let alone actually got on the seat and drove the buggy. And he's kind of smiled and said to me, "Imagine a bowling ball on an ironing board." Well, I kept that little phrase, and I kept my memory of Mr. Shetler as I wrote Separate from the World. And in the early chapters of the story, I sent a dwarf Amish man, Enos Erb, to visit Professor Brandon at Millersburg College. Now, Professor Brandon is one of the three male characters that typically appear in my stories. There's the professor, there's Pastor Caleb Troyer, and there's Sheriff Bruce Robertson. They and the women in their lives are the recurring English characters, the Yankees, in my stories. And then with each new mystery, there's a new set of Amish characters. And one of the lead characters in this story is a dwarf named Enos Erb. There has been a tragedy on the campus of Millersburg College. A young girl has apparently jumped to her death from the bell tower on campus. And the professor has reacted to this badly and finds himself walking home through the oak grove thinking about his student. Though his heart was wet with tears and his feet were cased in lead, he managed somehow to turn and start moving. He had only a distant notion that he should go somewhere, and after a few steps, he found he was headed home. He did not care where he was going, really. He merely followed his instincts to move forward in his sorrow, still in the fog of shock. In slower, irregular steps, he moved through the oak grove to the curb. His eyes were focused inward, but when he turned toward the parking lot behind the history building, he saw the dwarf, Enos Erb, guiding a buggy out of the lot. Brandon's vision seemed focused only on Erb and his buggy. His sight was tunneled, and the rest of the world around him was a blur. Erb drove a black buggy of regular size, hitched to a brown, standard-bred horse. He sat on the seat with his legs out straight, balanced like a bowling ball on a porch swing. Erb turned his horse in Brandon's direction, came up to him slowly, and stopped his buggy at the curb beside him. There was both sorrow and alarm in his eyes. Erb whispered, "Is that poor girl really dead?" And Brandon nodded. Erb studied his hands on the reins for several beats and then asked, "If sex is free, Professor, then what is left to cherish in marriage?" Brandon tipped his head but provided no answer. A long pause lay between the two men, and then Erb said, "Professor, that girl was young." Brandon nodded. He had no words to offer. Erb asked, "Do they really live together? Do they know each other like the bumps on their own heads?" "I suppose," Brandon said, feeling wearisome at the core. "We hear about these things," Erb remarked, aware of the professor's sorrow. He shook his head and added, "I've never seen a dead girl like that before. You know, a suicide." Because Brandon could think of nothing better to say, he responded simply, "I'm sorry you saw that, Mr. Erb," and added in a whisper, "She was my student." Gently, Erb said, "I'm sorry for you, Professor. I am truly so very sorry. I don't know what to say. Our children die too, you see. We lose them to diseases, and highway crashes with cars. There are sometimes accidents on the farm. Yes, we know death well, even the death of children, but not like that. Not suicide, Professor. I can't tell you that I know anything about suicide. In all of my stories, there's a central, theological issue that I try to bring out about Amish religion. Amish society is built on their understanding of Scripture, and everything in their life, all the things they think and do, is organized around how they interpret Scripture. So if there were to be a disagreement in an Amish congregation about medicine, it would have to be some kind of disagreement that could be traced with a certain amount of authority to Scripture in some way. So I want to read two passages next from this story. One, a talk Professor Brandon has with John Hirschberger, the deacon who wants to form a new church that goes modern. The people who will embrace modern medicine, the Amish who will follow him will partake in genetic studies. They will accept science and medicine and that much modern aspects of the English world. And the second person who speaks in this debate is, well, now that's interesting. I'll tell you in a minute. I spent all day yesterday with my seventh novel. I wrestled with a chapter full of new names and new people, and I must confess this second bishop's name has evaporated from my head. But I've got it right here, so I'm going to risk a little longer passage on theological issues so that you can see some of the subtle mentality that attaches to this discussion. These are serious-minded people who find themselves in deep disagreement about medicine, and I had to write about it in a way that wouldn't make it trivial. So I gave speeches to the two main Amish characters. First, the professor's conversation with John Hirschberger. The professor's name is Michael Brandon, with an E. At one point, Brandon asked, "Are you really a modern John?" Hirschberger smiled weakly and stroked his chin whiskers. "To a degree, Professor, concerning medicine, yes. But the good book says, be ye separate from the world." "What does the good book say about telephones?" Brandon asked. "You know it says nothing," Hirschberger replied evenly. "So you are to use your judgment," Brandon concluded. "Our discernment, rather," Hirschberger corrected. Going to the heart of the matter, Brandon asked, "Anybody's discernment, John, or just the bishop's? Your discernment when you formed your new modern church?" "A bishop is called to judge, to discern. We are all made strong through submission." "Well, to whom then?" the professor asked. "To God, of course, to the book. And what of modern medicines?" Here Hirschberger stalled. He considered a moment and said, "Our lives are supposed to be hard. Sacrifice and struggle teach us humility. Humility enhances grace, and God is glorified through our sufferings if we are submissive. But if God has made medicine possible, then we should accept it. That's where Andy Miller and I differ." Cal asked Cal Troyer, the preacher in my stories, Cal asked, "Is that needless suffering, John? How is God's grace amplified by needless suffering? If God has chosen us for trial of our faith, and we are all tried, the Bible promises, then we see that as a blessing. The trial of our faith is a blessing because it produces maturity. Our lives are surrendered to God so that we may know the full stature of a man in Christ's likeness." "Do you reject phones?" Brandon asked. "Yes." "Do you reject electricity?" Brandon asked, suspecting the answer. "We do." "Even batteries?" Brandon said. "Yes." Standing next to him, Israel cleared his throat, unhappy with Hershberger's answers, and Hershberger corrected himself. "Where a business is required to have light for safety, we are allowed a bulb. But in Israel's store there, he has only gas mantles for light. We will not compromise for reasons of convenience, only for safety when the law requires, and then for medicine." There it is, Brandon thought, the fringe of inconsistency. So the moderns have drawn a line. Electricity is outside, modern medicine is in. There were theological reasons why they do this. The other side of the argument is with Bishop Andy Miller, I see here. Bishop Miller answered all of the professor's questions calmly and carefully. When Brandon asked him to postpone the Sunday confession of John Hershberger, Miller's gaze turned sadly inward. He smiled like a reluctant sage and studied the redwood boards of the picnic table. When he turned his eyes up to Brandon's, he spoke slowly, deliberately, as if the sanctity of the whole congregation rested on how he answered this particular question. "If we don't do it, Professor," Miller asks, "who will keep the old ways? If we Amish don't keep the old ways, who will? And what is the new? Should a bishop tolerate any new doctrine? Should I allow the people to go out into any part of the English world they choose? Any part at all, Professor? Shall I let..." "Shall I tell a mother and a wife that it is acceptable to spend 2 hours a day at an exercise spa to lose weight when her family waits at home? What shall guide my decisions?" Professor Brandon tipped his head to acknowledge the questions without answering. "The people need authority, Professor. How else are they to understand the difficulties of the Bauern, the peasants? And does God ask of us more than a life of simple peasant farming? But a man will think he knows better than a bishop. He rehearses his reasons and thinks himself better. To do so is prideful, Professor. It is the start of a great fall. Others lose strength when this happens. Their sufferings then do not make them godly. They only make them miserable. Here is where grace is most diminished, because we all must suffer." So these are two very serious men who typically in Holmes County, Ohio, find themselves in deep disagreement over some very serious issues. It's not always just cell phones and electric wires. Well, that story got its start with the dwarf, Mr. Hershberger, whom I told you I met one day on my bicycle. I've been doing this for 30 years. 28, I don't know. wandering around Holmes County looking for things that are interesting. And I've been places that most people don't know about. You know, it's a tourist county now, isn't it? All along the blacktop roads, one finds things for sale to tourists. Berlin used to be a 22nd shot along Route 39 right through town. Now it's so congested in the summer with tour buses that you can spend 10 minutes just trying to get through town. And Holmes County has changed in one way more than any other in the last 30 years in this regard. The commerce that is offered to tourists, English folk like us, is so extensive now in Holmes County that it has very much changed the nature of what one sees there. So I have learned over the years, and I'll tell you my secret, that if you want really to meet authentic Amish people and talk about some interesting things with them, you've got to get off the blacktop. You want to find a gravel lane that skirts out over a ridge, or the tracks of two tires that run out across a pasture, and bravely just take your Miata right on down that road and wait for some one person to come speak with you. That's how I've done it in all the years that I've been traveling Holmes County, and that's where I've gotten my stories. Now, I'll tell you one last little story before I quit about a fellow out near Brewster, where they have a big dairy factory. They make cheese and milk and these types of things. A lady there owns a farm next door to an old order Amish family, and the father asked one day if he could borrow one of her books to read. Well, she gave to him a copy of Blood of the Prodigal, the first Ohio Amish mystery. He took it home and he read it and he liked it and he passed it around to his family and then to his friends, and they thought, what a good book. Okay, he brought it back. Nothing unusual yet. He asked, is there another one of these? And she lent him a copy of Broken English, the second Ohio Amish mystery. He read it and liked it. He shared it all around. He brought it back and asked for more, and as she was getting the third book, he remarked to her, these are such wonderful stories, and just think they're all true. Well, I assure you, the only thing real in the Ohio Amish Mysteries is the Holmes County setting. People have come up to me at book signings and assured me at great length that they know exactly where Millersburg College is, but frankly, I don't even know where it is. She explained to him, well, I'm sorry, no, sir, actually, it's an entirely a work of fiction, and he got quite angry. In fact, he stormed right out of her house, and it was two or three weeks before he came back to apologize. He said to her, I apologize for my rude behavior. I should not have gotten angry with you. But you see, the bishop in my district does not permit us to read fiction. So if you ask me, am I read in Holmes County, I can say, well, only half. Thank you.